Yeah, well, that's the. I told you about that guy who I had heard discovered on the one of those sync book broadcasts, one of those early 42 minutes, that Camille de Toledo in that book about coming of age at the end of history was sort of, you know, grappling with that whole idea of, like, you can't do anything that isn't then, you know, monetized and sold back to you and, you know, absorbed into the machine and the frustration and that's basically I mean, I'm a little older than you, but you probably at the same time where there, you know, you maybe had a memory or a taste of, you know, a period where it wasn't totally like that. But now it just seems that, you know, there's nothing that isn't colonized. You know, I mean, somebody posted some article about the automakers are trying to make it basically illegal to fix your own car, you know, and that, you know, because it's too complicated and dangerous or some such thing, but it's just another, you know, it's like,
we need to be protected.
Yeah. It's like, you can, you know, you can't collect rainwater. You can't raise your own chickens. You know, this
can't, your own milk. Also.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I don't know. I mean, if you're going to fight for something, I mean, that all just seems to be the things worth fighting for, the right to withdraw. I mean, I see this as the only response. The system is powerful. I mean, nobody's going to start a revolution. You know, it's just not going to happen. And they're ready for that. So, you know, the only response for the individual is to withdraw, to try to be as uninvolved in the thing as possible. And that's really, I mean, looking to the future, that's where I'm headed, you know, like get closer to where food is grown and things are done and, you know, have as little dependency on the system as you can manage. That's, again, that's another asymptote. You're not going to, you know, I mean, I live in Germany and I still have to pay taxes in the United States. You know, they won't let me go. You're dealing with that, but whatever, you know, you make the, I've given up perfection, you know, the attempt at perfection, and the most sensible thing I think you can do is just shoot for improvement.
Improvement of?
Well, there's two things. Of course, the quality of your own life, and then the support of a or non-support of a system that you don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
You're an American, you know, in my case, you're an American citizen, and then this gives this sort of abstract entity all these extortion rights, you know, that there's, you know, I don't know how to avoid it, you know, so it seems easier on the individual level to just give them what they want. I mean, I think very early, I guess in that transition from, you know, sort of left-wing radical thought to alternative perception, somewhere in that transition, the idea came to me that just pay your taxes and pay your rent and pay your taxes, and then people will just leave you alone and then just do what you want and think what you want within that space and try not to be so concerned about what the big meta machine is doing. Although I confess to have a certain morbid fascination with with what it's doing. So I've always sort of drawn back to material that
Yes, well, that's probably what brought you to my little corner of the margin.
Well, you're an independent thinker. That's the thing I respect the most, because, you know, I just see, it's just, I try not to have an emotional reaction to it, but I came up with this phrase, I call it hashtag robots, you know, where, like, one day you would, you know, you would go on, let's say, Facebook, you know, that I'm trying to wean myself off of, but, and then everybody, in one day, you know, you scroll down this thing, and it all says, Je suis Charlie, Je suis Charlie, Je suis Charlie, Je suis Charlie, and I think, like, well, how the hell did everybody spontaneously decide that this expresses what they're feeling? I mean, that's just impossible, and, I kind of draw this parallel of a kind of a, you know, you could look at this, some picture of Germany from the 30s where everybody's sort of marching together, and that's, you know, it's all kind of frightening, you know, when we look at it in these, like, black and white archive photos, and that it seemed that this Je suis Charlie business or whatever is Kony 2012 or, you know, any, because, you know, not to even get into the question of who branded this thing and why was it all ready to go, you know, that's a whole nother longer discussion, but it's a sort of social media equivalent of marching in lockstep, and that, you know, I told one people, well, why what do you mean, like, what are you saying, like, Je suis Charlie, what the hell does that mean? And then finally, you know, you push them long enough, and they say, well, you know, I'm against violence. And I say, well, fine, why the hell didn't you put that on your wall? If that's how you feel, like, just why did you take this prepackaged message and say, well, that's me, that represents me? You know, it does.
Yeah, that's, the rebellion has been contained, hey? It's been producted, branded, and sold back to.
Yeah, well, they say that Stalin or Lenin or somebody, you know, it's apocryphal whether they actually said this, that the best way to defeat the opposition is to lead it. Hmm. You know, but it's attributed to one of those friendly folk. So, yeah, you know, so, I mean, I told you, you know, I don't really care anymore about disseminating my name far and wide and doing all that. I mean, it seems more, you know, I don't want to make myself sound too saintly and humanitarian, but to nurture independent thought. Just people, whatever, you know, I don't really care what they believe as long as they've come to it on their own without just having this off the rack set of beliefs that they just put on, and, you know, it makes them look all right in public. You know?
Yeah, well, that's that was the slogan of this podcast, about the people who believe in free speech. It's a luxury for people who have learned to police their own thoughts, and me doing this podcast is very much about that. Not that I want to be a beacon of free thought, but that to enjoy the experience of discovering things and being able to communicate them, to bring them from the inner to the outer, and to have that, so the freedom is expressed. It's one thing to be, I mean, it's essential to be able to think, you know, to make associations and connections internally, to have that freedom, and I agree, I think that's been taken away very slowly or very rapidly, but very subtly. But then to actually to be able to share it and to bring it into form as a dialogue, that's the limits of the culture that I want to make. I almost think that podcasts should be disposable, but they can't. I mean, that's too idealistic. And so I'm rendering under Caesar in my own way, I think, like in other ways. Obviously, I have to pay my taxes and all the rest of that crap. But even in terms of being creative, and you know, I still, there's mixed motives there, because I'm still trying to get something back to some extent. But I think making a little offering to culture, to the Borg, to Mammon, to Caesar, as part and parcel of this exploration of the possibility of free expression. What a terrible phrase that has been totally co-opted now, but expression of the inner, you know, expression of our inner experience, our own reality. This is it. This is, you know, I bring my reality to you, one other person. I perhaps maybe wouldn't have done that if I wasn't doing the podcast, in a sense, and you wouldn't have emailed me.
No.
In a sense, the podcast is the context or the pretext for this dialogue, and maybe the dialogue is
real. Guy saying that, the French radio, was he the one saying, I forget who said that it was basically an excuse for community?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Didn't somebody say
the exact phrase?
That wasn't the phrase, I'm paraphrasing, but was the idea.
Yeah.
That something to, you know, it was a fire for people to gather around, basically.
Yeah.
Well, I'm optimistic about the little tree here you're growing in your garden. You know, all those things, talking about it is a sort of shift in the quantum field, and, you know, people who talk about it as just this very mechanical, methodical, you know, conspiracy by some elite for, you know, whatever agenda, depending on your orientation, you know, all those things can be simultaneously true as well. And if you follow anything far enough, you're always bumping up against what is the nature of reality.
Yeah, and this is why some intelligent people dismiss conspiracy, because, or conspiracy theory, or conspiracy fact even, or research, or whatever we're going to call it, because it all bleeds into each other, but including the more hard, tangible facts around it, because it's because of that, because it's, they will take the position that that there's always these anomalies, and then the mind creates patterns and tries to create a coherent narrative out of it, and so then we spin. And I think at some level, if you pull far enough back, or if you go deep enough in, or then that does start to happen. And then there's the question if, well, maybe that's what the conspirators are doing. They're conspiring to commit acts, but they're also conspiring to cover up the acts in such a way that the clues they leave will create a cover-up that will create perhaps a conspiracy where there wasn't a conspiracy, or a different kind of conspiracy. And it's so...
Well, that's how you can drive yourself nuts, I guess.
I know.
Because the other thing I would say is that, you know, where I think your guest of Paul Levy, was that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he, you know, when he say that it's not a contradiction that you are imposing a narrative on what is essentially random pixels out there, that is reality. Reality is our consciousness. I mean, the saying that it's a projection is not really negating. Because if you say, well, isn't the whole universe as we perceive it a projection, then, you know, you're there, which is...
Well, isn't it?
Have I articulated this?
Well, I don't know what you're trying to articulate, because to me, and I had this experience a bit with Paul as well, is that it sounds like you're saying something, but in fact you're not saying anything.
I'm saying that
the whole idea,
right.
that
well, I mean, you're saying that, well, there are these people, operators, you know, who are operating, arranging events so that this, and anticipating our reaction to that by doing that, this other thing, and it's a very mechanical Newtonian model. And
except it's not, because it's dependent on these operators knowing about the quantum fields and knowing what will happen. So it's both.
Okay.
It's allowing for both. And we have to allow for both, don't we? Because, I mean, this is the thing. This is where it's really hard to even think about. But
Is anybody really that smart?
Well, we're smart enough to talk about it, you know. Well,
yeah,
we're having a hard time
analyzing after the fact and creating it from...
Well, I think this is something people do all the time, though, even at an individual level, like perception management, sending out false signals to conceal what's really going on. I think it's almost instinctive that we do that, that we create... We try and control our own behavior and the signals that we're sending out in such a way that we will conceal and that we will benefit, and just the whole social, you know, navigation realm, basically the status and the power plays and the ego. So I think it's something that's instinctive, but it's also that can be learned, that can be mapped out and turned into a science, I would say. So it doesn't mean that it amounts to ultimate total control. I don't know. I mean, that would be the goal, of course. I would say it's not attainable just by the nature of things.
But if we are creating, if our consciousness is creating the reality or has a hand in fabricating the reality, then my consciousness and your consciousness have created that, you know, group of operators. So that's the point. That's in a nutshell. The Gordian knot that, you know, and how, you know, it, at some point you have to say that we've created that.
Well, I think the problem
with
this model,
if there is a them,
I think, you know, the problem with this model of that we create our reality is that it creates a duality where there isn't one. So my sense of this, to try and make any sense of it, is that at that level that you're talking about, there is no subject-object relationship. There is simply consciousness, and consciousness and what it perceives, or the contents of consciousness, are the same. Like the universal consciousness is a single happening. So there isn't then, there's no we that's creating the reality. So in that sense, I don't think that we do create reality. I think that we interpret reality and then interact with those interpretations, and so we create what's called false realities. But that's an oxymoron, right? If they're false, they're
not reality.
But
then, did you say so? You're saying there is an objective reality out there, and
I don't ever use the word objective, because that's a contradiction in terms. Like, if it was objective, there'd be no way to know. I'd say there is a subjective reality out there,
it's tough to forget to articulate the nature of reality.
I think that reality is non-negotiable. Like, it is beyond. I don't think we can influence reality. I think it influences us by definition, and we can split off from it, and then we can create interpretations, and we can deny it, and we can create these little pockets where we're relatively safe from reality. Like me, when I had my fortune, you know, I lived in a little bubble, and I could create and order the elements of my world in such a way that I didn't have to deal with reality, capital R, you know. So I think that that's a sort of metaphor for what we can do as consciousness, that we can create these little sub-realities in which we feel like we have control, and then it does seem like we are somehow shaping reality, just as if you win the lottery, or as you win at gambling, and then you use the money to improve your life, then you're influencing reality. You don't have to get quantum about it. But I think that that's a delusional thing. I mean, that's a seems to me that the nature of reality is like, how can I put it? That if you, to know it and to experience it, mm-hmm. objectively, quote unquote, you have to surrender to it and be immersed in it, and you just get swallowed up by it, and then you know it, but you are it. So it is completely subjective, but it is it. It is reality. It's final and it's non-negotiable. It's unchanging. Mm-hmm. It's eternal.
I'm not sure I agree.
Yeah.
Isn't there some tribe, you know, that you can read about in National Geographic, I guess, that sees the internal mental perceptual space and the external reality as a single undifferentiated continuum? They don't see any kind of division between, they don't acknowledge, I guess, any kind of division between those two things. And I don't know if this is apocryphal, because it's just something I heard, and I have no recollection of actually reading about such a tribe. But that kind of, I don't know, I think that kind of gets close to it. I mean, you can't, you know, I mean, obviously it'll be a never-ending thing about what is reality and the nature of reality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess, and what is the sort of cliche? There's only like five people who will really understand quantum physics. But at some point, you know, whether you follow a particle that is accelerating near the speed of light and observe what happens in a infinitesimally minute space of time with an infinitesimally small particle moving at an unfathomably high speed, And at that point, in that tiny space, at that speed, you do see this kind of warp between perception and the creation of reality. I think that much I got out of
quantum. Okay, well, but then perception and the creation of what's being perceived is what you mean, whereas what I'm trying clumsily to say is that perception is the ultimate reality, and perception is, it doesn't require contents. Like, this whole idea that there has to be something to perceive for perception to happen. Well, but everything that is perceivable phenomena is temporal. And if anything that... the only thing that could merit the term reality would be something that is eternal, because anything else dies, and then what? What's left after that?
So right? Then... So reality is just another word for God.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't really say anything. You just say, well, God's another word for reality. But let's say reality is another word for perception, or space, or even... I don't want to say it, actually, but I thought you were going to say, oh, reality is another word for nothingness or non-existence, and that seems to be where we end up. Because if we exist as a language-based identity, as in, if we can't think about it, we don't experience it or perceive it, we have to be able to, you know, we're existing in this language-based reality. Then whatever can't be described by language doesn't exist. And anything that's eternal, I mean, language can't cross the abyss into the eternal, right? Because language, by definition, is finite and temporal, and it's particle based, right? There's no wave. If you turn language into waves, you've just got an om, I guess. You know?
Yeah.
There's nothing left of it. So, but to bring it back to something, because we're getting very out there. This because we started talking about conspiracy and all that, and this is a problem, I think, in the field of just social interaction, social research, social engineering, trying to figure out what's real in the social realm, in the phenomenal world, is that pretty soon when you start looking at it, you get into these quantum models of reality, and then you get where we're getting, where it begins to seem irrelevant / impossible to actually determine the real from the unreal, because it begins to seem like it's all unreal. And this is, of course, counterproductive if you're trying to just figure out what's real and unreal in the phenomenal realm, in terms of really basic, like, what food should I eat, let's say, as a metaphor? What information can I trust? And what is actually deceiving and manipulating me? That, I think that's a real survival-based question, as much as eating good food.
Yeah, but all right. Well, I mean, it sounds like you got into the alternative healing thing at some point, and probably are still there. Now, don't you come across this thing, this sort of phenomenon, where you might get into a Western alternative-based healing philosophy, and they will tell you to, you know, I'm being reductionist, but just for illustration, you know, they'll tell you, eat raw, eat everything raw. Mm-hmm. And then if you go into a Chinese system, they'll tell you to cook everything.
Absolutely. So this is a good point, because what we need to eat, A, is individual. I mean, it doesn't vary a great deal, I don't think, because we're all, basically, we're the same at biological level, but it still varies somewhat. But B, it's experiential. So, and that, I guess the A and B are kind of the same, really. So maybe let's just say it's experiential. And the point is to actually be sensitive enough to develop a sensitivity where we begin to know what we can eat and have a healthy response to, and what we can eat and have an adverse reaction to.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we don't, I mean, those systems can help, but they're not, if we take them as a surrogate
possible
for actual experiential knowledge, then they're going to trick us anyway, right? So
resonance, that's the key.
We mean whether something resonates with you.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and coherence, whether it's coherent. If it resonates, then it coheres. And like the thing we were talking about with 9/11 and the notebook and all that stuff, I don't, you know, as far as whether 9/11 was an inside job, whether it was this, whether it was holograms, all that stuff is kind of brain candy for me, because I wasn't there. I don't even know for sure that it happened. But there are areas where it interfaces with my own direct experience, such as getting that notebook yesterday, where that narrative begins to have some sort of resonance for me, and it's kind of unpacking the clues in order to become conscious of something that is in the unconscious.
Yeah, I just don't think it's a political question at that point. It just becomes a question about your own path. You know, I mean, it's the same thing about all these 9/11 synchronicities. I don't so much take it as any kind of clues about what really happened. They're personal. They're things about, I take them, you know, what does it mean for me in my life and where I'm going and what is it trying to say and what direction is it pointing me toward?
Yeah. Do you know the website, Rigorous Intuition?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you know the forum Rigorous Intuition?
Never heard of it, but...
Okay, it's probably the most kind of respectable or popular, not popular because there's more popular ones, but forum for conspiracy discussions and stuff. It's been going for quite a few years. Jeff Wells was the guy who set it up. But anyway, I was just there. Now I just posted the Miles Mathis Bob Dylan piece. And there was a response about how the whole discussion about things being hoaxed is kind of forbidden at that forum. Like, they discuss conspiracies, but they try very hard to be... there is an attempt, there is an effort there to focus on the research and the more rigorous kind of research angle, as opposed to the kind of more wild kind of speculation. So,
you mean the crisis actor meme, or what do you mean by hoax?
Like Sandy Hook was a hoax, right?
There's
a
lot of stuff around.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That thing specifically, but more generally, like the planes being holograms, I almost got banned from there, not for propagating the idea, but for just including it in the discussion and just, well, you know, let's put that on the table too. Do we actually know? And that was a no-no in that community, because there's a feeling that, well, A, that a lot of these conspiracy theories are being put out there by operatives deliberately to poison the well, which I'm sure is true, and B, just because generally they it sort of starts to dissolve any boundaries of, as far as, if you put everything on the table, then you end up as we just did in these waters, where you're just saying, like Pontius Pilate, well, what is reality, right?
Mm-hmm. So did Pontius Pilate say that?
What is truth?
What is reality? Exactly. Well, you know, even this Lennon and Dylan stuff, you know, I when I was reading it, and then I thought, well, what if I wanted to raise the ante and say, you know, this guy, what's his name, Miles Mathis, what if he's the disinfo op and he's doing all of this and putting this together to as a way to take these people down because they've had too much cultural influence, and like that's the plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's the op, and Lenin himself was legitimate, and you know, this is why. Well, people who spend too much time in this material. I mean, not everybody, but it can be psychologically disruptive, I guess, because it just never ends, and it's a hall of mirrors, and what can you do? I mean, at some point, you just have to walk away from it. Or you could say, well, studying the Kennedy assassination or 9/11 or any of whatever it is gives my life some meaning, and the actual process of digging up these things gives me some sort of pleasure and resonates with me, and therefore I continue to do it. And I think that is probably the dividing line between the people who are sort of healthy versus the people who kind of go into some, that it just kind of drives them nuts.
Yeah.
We have been the victims of skillful social engineering and the automatic knee-jerk reaction to reject what I'm about to tell you about is wrong. It is a mistake. I am telling the truth. And all through the show, all night, you will hear somebody telling the truth. No matter how strange it seems, just remember, you've been tricked. This is the truth.
Describe in some detail. I mean, a lot of what you said, I think, has contributed to the modern conception of what a gray is.
Yeah.
The thing, with Edward Bernays and all this about the focus group and market research is that they have somehow learned how to create a mold. As a result of these processes, the things they do, they have learned how to create a mold into which a product and a pitch can be poured. So that you have this mold of consumer desire, expectation, attitude, all these kind of things. And into that, they figure out, all right, this is the layout. Now, how do we put a product and a pitch to sort of lock and key style to fit this mold that we just created? And that's what they do to sell toothpaste, to sell politicians, to sell any damn thing they're going to sell. And which now everything is commodified, so everything is up for sale.
I was just looking for a quote, but I couldn't find it. It was a Neil Postman book I read recently, The Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Yeah, I know.
You know that book?
Well, I'm familiar with the book, sure.
Mm. Yeah, I can't find it. I can't remember it, but it was really good.
Well, personally, I don't trust anyone published by anyone who gives a TED Talk, anyone who's published by a mainstream imprint. It's all suspect, it all begs the question, what are they selling? And the question, what are they selling, just taints everything.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're preaching to the choir here, but it's more significant coming from you because you have been published by some of those corporate...
Yeah, don't believe me either. Well, you know, at the time, it was frustrating. I told you, I mean, I didn't belong there. It was a good gig. You know, I had a good life. It subsidized a very comfortable existence. I mean, people ask me, you know, why'd you become a writer? And I wouldn't say it's because I love writing. I mean, I did as a child. I could recall, you know, sitting and just writing on my own as a child. But really, you know, it was this image of my parents getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning and going to work and, you know, coming home in the evening. And I couldn't fathom living that way. Mm-hmm. It just seemed horrible. So writing seemed to, you know, I was aware of having this skill, and I just thought, well, this is a ticket out of this dungeon of this, you know, get up in the morning, drink your coffee, fight the traffic to get to your job, and, you know, do whatever you have to do to get through the day and come home and then prop your feet up. And so that's why I did that. It wasn't, you know, very little is me. You know, there was only very few opportunities in a long career to for me to look at something I wrote and say, yes, that is an expression of me. People ask me how they get started in writing, you know, how to be successful as a freelance writer. And, you know, I tell them, well, it's all different now, that I wouldn't do it the way I did it then, because now it's about basically, you know, if you want to put it into a sort of a corporate marketing lingo, it's becoming a brand, but it's really about going out there and finding enough people who say, hey, I like what this guy is saying. And, you know, the people I listen to, there are people I listen to, they're completely unacknowledged in the mainstream, and yet they have huge followings. And they are followings that, to the best of my knowledge and from what I could tell, are organic. That they just started doing their thing and people said, hey, wow, hey, this guy's saying, wow, have you heard what this guy said? Why not be part of that? I mean, that's just much more gratifying.
Well, what's an example of this, somebody who has a huge following who's not mainstream?
Well, James Corbett.
That's who I was thinking of, funny enough, the Corbett Report, right?
Yeah, he's just some nerdy guy doing his thing, and people are, more and more people just stumble upon him, or I don't know how they find him, and they go, hey, wow, look at that guy.
Maybe. Huh? But then maybe not. Like, Red Ice apparently started like that. But look at Red Ice now. Now we're...
Well, you know, that whole business with Red Ice, I mean, I wasn't so much put off by it, except that the single-minded obsession with this race business became boring, I guess. And so I haven't paid attention to what Henrik is up to in quite a while.
You're a smart guy, so if the social engineers want to fool as many people as they can, as much of the time as they can, then they know that if the smart, more discerning listeners and readers don't go to the mainstream anymore, they look for seemingly out of nowhere marginal guys who are just doing their thing, nerdy guys who, yeah, they have some measure of success. But so, and so that, you know, they have to be well known enough that guys like you will find them. But so how do we know that that isn't just the latest?
Well, we don't. We don't. But I mean, I also think that they don't think in terms of 100% and sopping up the last 2 or 3%. I mean, I think that Alex Jones is enough to get that, you know, enough of that demographic. Alex Jones and his...
As you said about Strieber, like, Jones is probably already passé. Like, a certain point, they reach the sell-by date and people do become jaded and cynical and people do start to smell a rat.
Because Jones, so maybe, I mean,
even Jones was cool back in Waking Life day, you know, when he was completely unknown, and I saw him in Waking Life. I thought that guy's pretty cool.
Have you seen these things that say that Bill Hicks and Alex Jones are the same person?
No.
This is an interesting... I mean, I was... They make a compelling... I mean, they do some facial stuff between Bill Hicks. You know, what would Bill Hicks look like now? And, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but they're both performers. So it's like, well, it's not that ridiculous. And, I mean, I wasn't aware of Bill Hicks too much when he was alive. I was only kind of introduced him after he was dead. So I didn't follow him. But supposedly he disappears right at the time that Alex Jones appears.
Wow. It's probably the same psychic fragment.
Yeah, it's not important. You know, it's the same what I was saying about collecting these facts. You know, if you're collecting these facts, to think that you're going to come up with a smoking gun that's, you know, going to blow the whole thing wide open, whatever it is, you know, Kennedy assassination or whatever, it's never going to happen, and you're just going to be frustrated, and you're just going to be spinning in a environment where there's no compass and no orientation to anything, and you'll be lost. I would say people like, whatever, it was on your show, Adam Gorightly, he probably maintains his sanity because he just enjoys going through all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a nice, a gratifying way for him to spend his day or night. And, you know, he gives back some of what he finds. He's able to sort of digest it and present it back. So he's, you know, helping other people who, whatever, want to be entertained or informed. And that's all fine. So he seems, I don't know him personally. I mean, I know people who know him, but, you know, that seems to be the key to his stability and longevity. And he's just doing it because he likes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's a good gauge for whether somebody is trustworthy, actually. Because if operatives are doing it as a job, they're not doing it because they like it.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can be neither an operative nor doing it because you like it, but doing it as a mission and a cause, like David Icke. I don't really think Icke's an operative, although he could be, of course.
Well, it's also endemic to everyone who has a kind of an alternative reality theory, that an alternative reality theory leads to a kind of a place that seems absurd.
Sure.
That's how it is. You know, I just... that's just how it is. And, you know, spend your life in it if it interests you, and if you could connect it to other things. And the only other thing is that you use it to be able to perceive reality the way it is, you know, as much as possible, and not to be driven by forces that you're not aware of, whether they're internal or external.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but having said all that, I ask people not to believe me, because I don't have all the answers either. But to the best of my, you know, aspirations, that's where I'd like to be, or moving in that direction.
Yeah, I think this came up on one of the podcasts about discernment, like how to learn discernment, you need discernment, right? To know, you have to be able to discern within yourself, like I was talking about food, what's good for you and what's not good for you. Same with information, is this real, is this nourishing or is it not? In order to identify the nourishing from the unnourishing, you have to have discernment. But how do you develop discernment? You've got to actually be able to discern the signals in your own body. So it's kind of a catch-22, like you need discernment to learn discernment. And that
was he in on the whole thing too, Heller? I'd be crushed.
Who's Heller? Oh, catch-22.
Just Heller.
Yeah. He would, yeah.
I mean, they got the Snowden name from Catch-22. This is completely... Was he in on it? Is he a Salinger? Huh?
Yeah, whatever. I mean, I wasn't a fan of him, so for me that's not an issue. But if it was David Byrne or Bukowski, then it would become more of an issue. But so this is like part of the challenge, isn't it? Like if you're emotionally invested in narratives and whatnot and believing stuff, it becomes much harder just to tune into that part of you that can just tell what's real and what's not real, because you have a vested interest in one version.
Yeah, well, the Bob Dylan thing was, like I said, a big blow, but really, could the CIA have, like, the absolute greatest songwriters in the world working for them? I mean, do they scoop them up at a young age? I mean, where do those lyrics come from then? I mean,
according to that article, it was Leonard Cohen, so it wasn't saying the CIA wrote them, but... And I think
that part. I've got to read it again. They said Leonard Cohen wrote Bob Dylan songs?
Not all of them, but that was the name that Mathis ended up throwing out there. Not convincingly, but not, you know, absurdly either. There was some substance to what he was saying, and I think there is some substance to the idea that Bob Dylan or anyone else was being manipulated doesn't mean that he was actually an operative, like the extent to which he was aware of it, and then even given that he was aware of it, the extent to which he actually was that kind of person who believed in those things, you know, that he was a complete hypocrite. It could just be that he made a deal with the devil and said, well, I want to be successful and I want to get out and my message out, and this is the only way to do it. And I think there's certainly a very easy to imagine rationale for that I can do more good if I make this bargain with these forces and they think that they're using me, but actually I'll be using them. I think that happens in the psyche, you know, with the Guardian.
Well, I think that's what Timothy Leary probably thought. If all that they say about him is true, and how much these people are, how much how correct it is that they're playing. Well, at some point, they may be playing their own game also in this whole thing. I mean, that's possible as well. I think that was suggested a lot with McKenna, you know, saying, well,
I think it has to be. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that Urban maybe doesn't allow, and it's wanting to have an either-or thing. But yeah. I had this experience. I'll try and keep it brief because I got to start cooking soon.
Yeah, we got to wrap it up.
But in the airport once, where I was refused entry to the U.S. and I'd flown from England to the U.S. and I basically they wouldn't let me in, and it was the day before my birthday, and I was going to go to San Francisco and pursue my film career, and they wanted to send me back to England, and I was like, it's my birthday tomorrow, please can you just send me to Mexico instead? And this is not the kind of thing that immigration officials do, you know. They've got, it's a basic, it's very cut and dried. Either they send you back where you came from, or they send you back to, you know, where you're a citizen of. Those are the options, and they don't, you know, you're just a problem.
They don't negotiate.
No, and so it wasn't like I was putting my foot down. I just made this request, and there was this guy there called Agent Johnson, and he was a high-ranking immigration officer. I don't even know what his rank was, but he, at a certain point, he overheard what was going on, and he interceded, and he actually took over my whole case, and he arranged it so that I could get to Mexico. I didn't have enough money to buy the extra ticket. He escorted me out of the airport to a cash machine. He basically took me under his wing and made it possible for me to get bounced, not back to England where I'd have been fucked, but to Mexico where I wanted to be if I couldn't get into the US. So it's kind of like, it was like divine intervention. And yeah, it was this, he was an immigration officer, and he was very hard ass. You could see that he was not somebody who took shit from anybody, but there was something anomalous about him. And during the period in which he escorted me out of the airport, the elevator, he was complaining to me about Bill Clinton, the weasel Bill Clinton, and then he said, we haven't had a good president since Nixon. Kennedy.
Kennedy.
And they killed him, right? So basically, this guy was a conspiracy theorist, immigration officer, who had, for no reason, I mean, no personal gain to himself, had intervened in my case. I won't even say took pity on me. It's just he, I don't know. But my experience of that was that there are inside agents within the machinery of the Matrix, if you will, who are pursuing their own agendas. And they work for higher forces, metaphorically speaking. Like, I'm sure he could be an asshole.
When you said that there are agents and all of that, I thought about all the different levels, meanings you could ascribe to those words. And it's and then that started the whole Castaneda, Mexico, whatever, your whole hippie trip.
That was the return to that. I had already done that, and I had just written Blood Poets, and I wanted to be in San Francisco to promote the book and to pursue my film career, but I knew that it might not be on the cards for me, and so I also knew that I might not be able to get into the US because I'd been refused entry the last time, post Mexican Castaneda thing. And so I said, well, to myself, if I can't get into the US and pursue my film career, I'll return to Mexico and pick up the sorcery path. And so that was how I ended up living in Guatemala.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
You have just been listening to Jason Horsley, that's me, talking with markerman.com. Well, actually with Mark, but that was his website. If you want to participate in any capacity with the Liminal Project, give feedback, etc., some useful links, kubricon.com/maze is the forum where nothing is happening currently. Send me an email if you do join so I can authorize your account. Send me an email with feedback, jason@horticulture.com, or comment at the blog, horticulture.wordpress.com, or at the website where you downloaded this podcast. To support this podcast in more material ways, i.e. by making a donation, go to patreon.com/liminalist or to the blog link at horticulture.com. That's it until next week, where I'll be talking to the cleaver, Mr. Neil Kramer. Till then, be liminal, but don't be a criminal.